Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome back to the show Roger Houston, the author of 22 books, including the best-selling 10 Poems series. He's a native of England, but now makes his home in Marin County, California, and teaches around the world. His work has been featured in such esteemed outlets as the New York Times, Oprah Magazine, and the Huffington Post. And his latest book, A Swan Song of Kinds, although I affirm he'll provide us with a few more books after this, it's entitled Dropping the Struggle, Seven Ways to Love the Life That You Have. And as usually, it's an elegantly and warmly written book with sensitive references to a variety of authors and poets, and as well as personal and shared stories that illustrate his themes. So it's a lovely read, actually. And if you like Pema Chodron and some of the writings that she has, you're going to love this book because it's similar themes in a way. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Roger Houston back to the show. Welcome, Roger.
Thanks so much, Paul.
You know, you say you were an inveterate seeker for many years, and it wasn't easy or even seemingly natural to drop the struggle. So tell us about that. You traveled widely, didn't you?
Well, I still do to some degree, but yes, I have in my life generally traveled a great deal. I think I said in the book that for many years I had a severe dose of seeker's disease.
Right.
In other words, you know, the golden goose always lay somewhere else, anywhere where I hadn't yet got to. So the grass was always greener somewhere else, you know. So, you know, it took me quite a long time to really realize that what I really wanted and was looking for was really here with me all the time.
Yeah, so that's the kind of open secret, isn't it?
Open secret.
Yeah, yeah. I like the Sufi saying, and it says, what we seek cannot be found by seeking, and yet only seekers find it. You know, there's an inbuilt conundrum there, isn't it? You have to, in some way, put yourself in a position to seek something, and yet you realize ultimately that it's already here. Right under your nose, and as it is, I was referring to Tony Parsons in my message on Sunday. I don't know if you're familiar with Tony, but he's a non-dual thinker from Britain. And
yes, I do know him.
Yeah, you're familiar with him. Yeah, mm-hmm. A wonderful book, As It Is, that I love. And you know, he talks about the very same thing. I think he was in a park in London when he was 20, and suddenly he just dropped all his future think and was just aware of his walking, and then he wasn't even aware of his walking. he was just walking, and his sense of self disappeared, and he was part of everything. And this, you know, talk about dropping the struggle. That was his breakthrough moment into this allowing. And you use that word a lot, don't you, in the book? This allowing it to happen, allowing something to arise to be revealed.
I do, yes. And I use that advisedly, you know, as distinct, for example, to the word accepting. Mm. You know, there's nothing wrong with the word accepting, but it can have, you know, the kind of subtle kind of undertone of, well, you know, this is the way it is, so you might as well put up with it. Just
kind of, resignation, accept. Yeah.
Yeah, the kind of... There is a kind of resignation, I think, at least potentially inherent in the word acceptance, which is why, you know, why I use the word allowing, or even welcoming, actually. And allowing what? Welcoming what? Well, what is before us in this moment? That is, life itself as it's presenting itself to me, moment to moment, because after all, that really is the only life I have, and my suffering happens or is caused by my essentially by resisting what is there before me,
yes.
wanting it to be something else.
And yet, there's
and
also
that's part of the seeker's disease. You know, I mean, the seeker's disease is always pulling us by the nose because with the promise that something is. Something better lies just around the corner.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's at the same time, there is a sense of conflict, isn't there, or struggle in being human. But the part of the human condition involves that. I quoted something from the Lankavatara Sutra on Sunday, where I really love. It says, nothing is as it seems, but neither is it otherwise. In other words, you know, isn't that lovely?
I love
that one. Yeah, because it's true, isn't it, that you know, we don't see things clearly, but there's no alternate reality other than this one that we can escape to, you know, where everything is perfect. We have to see this one correctly, and then the flower opens, if you like. You've got a wonderful quote from Henry Miller right at the beginning of the book. Do you want to read it, or shall I?
Would you?
Because yeah, sure.
I know. Yes, please do.
Yeah, okay. Because it really sums up the book in some ways, I think. It says, life, as we all know, is conflict. And man, being part of life, is himself an expression of conflict. If he recognizes the fact and accepts it, he is apt, despite the conflict, to know peace and to enjoy it. There's the conundrum. But to arrive at this end, a man has got to learn the doctrine of acceptance, or as we putting it, allowing, that is, of unconditional surrender, which is love. And of course, we balk against this. You know, the idea of unconditional surrender is something only the defeated do. But unconditional surrender this way is freedom, isn't it? And I love the way he says unconditional surrender is love, right? So there it is, all embraced in that one paragraph.
Yeah. No, thanks for reading that. That's beautiful. And it's true, you know. Yeah, of course, struggle is part of our life. There's nobody who hasn't struggled or doesn't struggle at one time or another. And there are places where it's appropriate. It's really to do with survival. After all, we even struggle coming out of the womb and into this world, don't we? Or at least most of us do. You know, struggling through the birth canal. So you know, there is a place for that, but. Where struggle has proven to be counterproductive for me is in really those deeper existential issues that all of us face at one time or another. And I just had an interruption there. Yeah. For example, the whole theme or subject of meaning or purpose or love, for that matter. You know, I certainly in my life, the struggle for meaning or for love, just has not worked. You know, another way has been necessary. And also those existential givens of life, for example, change, you know, the fact that everything changes. And so many of us struggle against this irrevocable fact of change. So there has to be another way, really, for us to embrace change, or at least acknowledge and surrender to the reality of it.
Yes.
So these areas, you know, these existential areas or deeper areas, you know, they will never be resolved through struggle.
Well, and behind it all is this sense of separation, isn't it? This sense that, you know, I'm apart from the universe or others, or and therefore I'm either nothing or I'm special. You know, that I have to be special because I have to make myself felt. I'm a fearful being in an unfriendly universe, and got to have something special happen to me to validate who I am, and or search for love or meaning or whatever. And you know, you have chapters where you talk about these things, and the fact that in order to be the marvelous being that we are, we don't have to be special, right? You have that whole description where you were arrested by the Iranian intelligence service, and it looked pretty hairy for a few days, you know, that you might end up in prison or whatever, or worse, and because it's happened to many people, unfortunately. And you had that moment of surrender, of release, right? Of knowing that whatever happened, it was all okay in some sense. You didn't want to be there, but you'd gone beyond. I thought it was a wonderful description there in the book.
Yes, thank you. Well, really, you know, yes, this whole theme of being special really does come down to what you were pointing to, which is the sense of separateness and our usually unconscious attempts to resolve this sense of alienation or separateness by trying to feel special and, you know, more than in some way those around us, so that we stand out and then we feel significant in some way. And, you know, that is, again, it's part of being human in some degree, in the sense that, you know, we do need to feel significant and substantial, and of course fundamentally we are, but, you know, the way in which we're trying to validate that is usually through our outer identity, that is, what we do in the world or how wealthy we are, you know, these kind of criteria for feeling special. And of course they don't, you know, they really don't work. You know, we succeed in one goal that we think is going to make us stand out, and it does, but then, you know, 6 months later or a year later, you know, the shine has palled and we need to do something else, you know, to keep up the face, if you like. So, you know, Jefferson had this lovely line where he said, remember that nobody is better than you are, but you are no better than anyone else.
Right.
It's a kind of great leveler, really.
Absolutely.
And yes, you were speaking about my experience in Iran. It's true, you know, that there's something I think that I've had to acknowledge there, that was in my travels around the world and in going about my life. I think unconsciously I tended to have a sense that I had some kind of special pass. In other words, I always thought, you know, no harm will come. I can go to Iran or anywhere, really, and it'll be fine. It'll be all right, you know. And also I have this English passport, you know, and being an English white male, already, you know, it connects you to these generations of Englishmen striding around the globe thinking they were very special indeed. And it's almost like a kind of racial thing that, you know, we inherit in some degree, whether we like it or not. And it takes a few years to realize, of course, that it was complete nonsense. But you know, that is part of the inheritance. And so it was really invaluable, actually, for me to meet these and spend these days with these intelligence agents who took all that away from me. I mean, they held up my passport and said, "You realize this is completely worthless." And then they threw it into the waste paper basket.
Right.
And they said, "You know, as far as anyone else is concerned, you could disappear now forever and nobody would ever know." And of course, they were right. And when they left me alone, they went out of the room. They said they'd be 5 minutes. In fact, they were an hour. And that was one of the most valuable hours, really, of my life. Because, you know, I really got that the story of my life, you know, the narrative that I'd thought to be Roger the writer living in San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera, it was a fabrication spun out of my neurons. And for all I knew, the next day I'd have a completely different story. Perhaps my story would be prisoner in Avine prison for the next 5 years, torture or whatever. I didn't know, but I did know that my identity as I knew it, my story as I knew it, was utterly provisional.
But yes, very good.
It felt really like a suit of clothes, too tight suit of clothes, dropping away. And the amazing thing is that as that fell away, that identity that, you know, I thought to be me, I continued existing. And, you know, I was just aware of an aliveness simply of I am, that had nothing to do with that particular identity, that, you know, wanted to feel special or wanted to do this or do that. All of that fell away, and I was simply there, breathing.
And you had everything you needed in that moment, you know.
Yeah. And when they came back in the door, I actually saw them as kindred spirits in the sense of other human beings. I saw that actually they were just doing their roles. They were identified with their identity, and they couldn't help it. That's what they were doing. But beneath that, through that, I saw that they were no different to me.
Right. Yeah, they were doing the dance that was theirs to do. Yeah.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Well, you know, there was a diplomat, I think, in Uruguay or Paraguay years ago, a British diplomat, who was arrested and threatened with torture and everything. And his way through was to just decide he was already dead. And so they couldn't really hurt him because he was already dead. And it was the same kind of experience, I think. It was releasing and letting go of the self-pity that comes from identifying with your body or your feelings, whatever. And so, you know, after he was dead, he said he had a great calm come over him because he thought, you know, that's fine. Whatever happens after now, you know, after this, is fine because I'm already gone. I'm already dead. And so they can't really do anything to me. And I thought, I've always been impressed with that because I thought that's a good way of approach, you know, to die before you die, as the Sufis say. You know, it's a salutary way of approaching life. I want to just say that Tony Parsons, you know, when he had that breakthrough moment in the park, he noticed that every single footstep he made was unique, never to be repeated, and yet it disappeared, right? It was completely gone. So he was both simultaneously like that. His footsteps were unique and yet profligate, you know, they were gone. God just, you know, threw them away, but only to put another one in place. And I think this is our lives, isn't it? You know, totally insignificant in a sense, and yet totally unique, both at the same time, you know. And this is the magnificence, I think, of the freedom that comes when we could drop the story, drop the ideas we have about ourselves, and simply be present.
That's a really beautiful illustration, Paul. Yes, absolutely. Each step is completely unique and is gone in an instant.
Yes.
This one. Yeah. Yeah. And who are we then but the gap between the steps?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's why we have to mind the gap, as they say in London, right?
Absolutely. I'm reminded every time.
That's right, absolutely. All right, I'm with Roger Houston. We're talking about his wonderful new book. It's called Dropping the Struggle, 7 Ways to Love the Life You Have. And for those of us who are struggling, and the struggle seems to be accelerating in our society right now, and the speed of everything, the busyness, the hassles, the fear, it's a very salutary book to bring some sense of calm, and the fact that the answer is not somewhere far off, but right here where we are. So let's take a break. We'll listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes with Roger Houston. Join us then.
Wouldn't you like to share the programs that inspire you most with audiences around the world? That's easier than ever with mobile giving. Just text Unity Radio to 72727 and help us continue offering spiritual programs that change lives.
Have you asked your soul what it wants? Or are you so busy meeting the needs of everyone else? Family, friends, children, bosses, that you haven't checked in with the part of you that matters most? Janet Connor asked this question and received an answer. Your soul wants 5 things. That's it. 5 things. Your soul wants to connect with Source, commit to values, serve a purpose, express itself creatively, and last, it longs to create a beautiful, abundant life. Janet Connor teaches 5 wisdom habits that meet those needs. You can take each course separately or register for the complete Your Soul Wants 5 Things series and receive $1,000 in bonuses for free. Visit JanetConnor.com and explore all 5 courses in her signature series, Your Soul Wants 5 Things. Your soul will thank you.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants 5 Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome to today's show. By the way, my new article in the Unity Leaders Journal, Standing Firmly in Truth in the Midst of Tragedy, is out, and I put a copy of it on my website, pauljohnroach.com. Check that out. I'm getting a lot of good feedback from it, so love you to read it and give me your feedback too. I'm with Roger Houston. We're talking about his lovely new book, Dropping the Struggle, very elegantly and approachingly written. It draws you in. There's lots of meat to it, which is always nice. But the meat is presented in a very easy to swallow way, you could say. Then, and on page 40, you provide us with three ways of approach with anything that's happening in our lives, right? I'll just sketch it out. But you can approach it with a closed mind, which is sort of denial, ignore it, it doesn't exist, or a lost mind, which is identifying with the story or with the thought and feeling and react as if it was true. And then the open mind, which is experience the thought and feeling without judgment or fear and know it for what it is, a narrative imposed on reality and not the truth about reality. So we would get these three approaches to healthy living. And obviously closed mind, lost mind, not so effective because we're lost in our own struggle. We're lost in our own humanness. But the open mind is the teachable mind. Yes?
That's a great way of putting it, yeah. And what it's teaching us is the very moment itself that we're living. So, you know, a closed mind, you know, is often demonstrated by really closing off or denying our own inner experience. So, you know, usually or mostly because we judge it as not appropriate or bad or wrong or something. So, for example, feeling angry or feeling vulnerable, feeling ashamed, whatever that feeling is, that, you know, is something that, first of all, can apparently tarnish one's own self-image, but also is something one just doesn't really want to feel. So a closed mind would just block that off and pretend it's not happening. And, you know, the mind that gets lost in the feeling is the one who is completely taken over by it and acting it out. And yes, the third possibility or opportunity is again, to be quick enough, to be open and aware enough, awake enough, to know what is happening inside oneself and to allow it, welcome it even, without judgment, without judging it, and without acting it out. But the willingness to feel it is in itself a kind of inquiry.
Yes.
The willingness to actually feel it is, you know, is without acting it out, is allowing us to drop down deeper into the feeling that we're having and perhaps to see the cause, which usually has nothing to do with what we think.
I like the idea that, you know, it doesn't have to be all sweetness and light. You know, this idea that we could learn as much in our darkness and in our struggle, in our pain and suffering, as we can in, you know, those moments of radiant aha, beauty and joy, that it's simply being attentive to what is at any given time is the ultimate freedom. Because, like you said, it's not about the thing itself, the presentation itself. It's about who is looking at this, who is always free, right? So you can look at anything and become free. It doesn't have to be a good or a bad, quote, experience. And I think Pema Chodron talks about this, you know, with her famous line, lean into the sharp points. You know, it's those moments where we don't want to lean into the sharp points, usually, that we fear them. But if we can, we suddenly become, you know, you had a really sharp point there in Iran. So, you know, if we can lean into it, we can suddenly become very much alive. There's a poem in there about tasting the fruit that comes from these apparent reverses in our lives, you know, where things don't work out. In fact, you have a chapter on that, right? Going beyond perfectionism, you know, everything's broken open so that we can let the present splendor come out.
Yes, absolutely. While you were speaking to that, actually, I was reminded of the one lesson in the Course in Miracles that I've remembered for the last 30 years, which is, you are never upset for the reason you think.
Right. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Because it's always true.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we may get upset at the way our partner is pouring our tea. You know, it could be anything ridiculously simple and banal, but it's actually not about pouring the tea. And if we actually can allow ourselves to experience the feeling we're having in the body, not just the mind, but experience the body that we're the feeling that we're having in the body, we might drop down deeper to then the tea being poured. You know,
right.
Who knows where it may have come from, but. Yeah, well, you know, so, or it's as if, you know, in every moment we're living in one degree or another, the entirety of our life is present. All of it, from the moment we were born, all of it somehow is present in this one moment, which is why you're never upset for the reason you think.
This might be a good mantra for Donald Trump right now after the first debate. You are not upset for the reason you think. You know, because he tends to react to a lot of things. And it's a good object lesson to watch, actually, because you think, my goodness, did he need to go there? You know, because he's missing out on speaking his truth because he's reacting so much to, you know, what somebody else is skillfully making him do. And this can happen to us in our own lives, isn't it? We can be, you know, foolishly used by our own human egos.
Well, especially by our own narcissism. And you just mentioned probably one of the best-known narcissists of all time. and the truth is, you know... for a narcissist, you know, first of all, you can never, ever say that you're wrong. So there's an absolute refusal to say that you made a mistake or that you're wrong, because you have to feel special. And the essence of being a narcissist is feeling that you really are a cut above everyone else in some way or another, you know. So that then if someone criticizes you, you are not going to let them go, because, you know, that is your weak point, you know, that you simply cannot take criticism, because the image you have of yourself might be broken. And remember, I was talking about being in Iran, where, you know, the story of my life, that is my identity as I thought it was, that is what was challenged and fell away. It just fell away because I could see, you know, how provisional it was. But, you know, I've not always lived like that. I mean, you know, there'll be other times earlier in my life where if my identity was challenged, you know, I would push back.
Yes.
Because my identity is all I thought I was. And, of course, it's not who we are at all. That is our familiar identity. It's truly not who we are. But if we really solidly believe it is, as clearly Mr. Trump does, then you simply cannot allow any attack on it. You know, you simply can't, because you've got nothing else.
Right.
Because that, and so there's this great desire, and you brought up the question of being perfect, and you know, this is part, I think, of the desire to appear perfect, to try and have the perfect life. And of course, we all know that it just is never going to work, because we live, number one, we live in an imperfect, evidently imperfect world. But not only that, we ourselves are imperfect. You know, we're never going to get, well, speaking for me, I'm never going to get all my, I'm never going to get all my ducks in a row.
Right.
I'm just not. I mean, you know, try as I might, you know, the perfect relationship, the perfect work, you know, the perfect house, the perfect weather. I mean, it's just not going to happen. There's always going to be something. Because, why? Because there's something wrong with me? No, because that's the way life is. You know, it's beautifully imperfect.
The Japanese
really understand this. The Japanese really understand this. They have
wabi-sabi.
They have a whole art form known as wabi-sabi, which really, you know, actually celebrates the imperfections in a piece of ceramic or a pot or a garden, whatever it may be. And there are many cultures, actually, not only the Japanese, but in the Middle East, the Iranians, actually, who deliberately include a mistake or imperfection in their work, for example, in a carpet, because, you know, there's just the knowledge that this is a more accurate reflection of light. This is really what Leonard Cohen, in that wonderful line, points to, you know. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Yeah, one of my favorite lines. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And of course, when he says everything, he means me and you.
Yes.
You know, it's me and you, you know. I mean, or certainly me anyway. I mean, that's it.
Well, you know, in the Bible, where it says in the traditional translation, you know, you must be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect, from the Sermon on the Mount, I think a more accurate translation, and I see it used now in the Common English Bible and other Bibles, it says you must be as complete and full as your Father is complete and full. And I love that idea, you know, get beyond perfection to completeness. It's the holism of this, isn't it? We're embracing the whole of things, which includes the imperfection, which includes the transient, the ineffable, the decay in things. You know, is all part of that completeness, that wholeness. And so we're invited to live wholehearted lives rather than perfect lives. And to me, that's a lovely idea. You know, I think the Native Americans have the same idea of leaving some imperfection, but it's that which creates the hoop of the world, the wholeness, you know, is embraces the imperfection.
That's lovely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you were speaking, I was reminded of those lovely lines by the Spanish poet Antonio Machado, where he says, the golden bees are making white combs and sweet, sweet honey from all my old failures.
Yeah, I love it.
You know, what that implies is that nothing actually goes to waste.
Yes.
And, you know, we know in our own lives that those turns in the road of our life that we at the time considered terrible or drastic or even tragic, in hindsight often prove to have been the great gifts in our life.
We talk about this a lot in service, yeah, that's the nature of things. Also, the embrace of the unknown. You know, you have a lovely quote from another Spanish writer, Gabriel Garcia, or Latin writer, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, said of his wife, "I know her so well that she is completely and utterly unknown to me." I know that feeling. You know, the more you know somebody, the more you don't know them, but you're okay with that. You rest in that unknowingness. And in fact, it's that mystery that brings you together more intimately. Because if you think you know someone, it's almost the rejection of the person. And so the great unknowing is the intimate embrace, you know, and the magnificence of the opportunity to be with something unknowable in that way. You know, that's a beautiful thing, I think.
Absolutely. And we can extend that from, you know, our partner or friend, or to life itself, to everything, because fundamentally, surely, this moment really is a mystery.
Yes.
This moment right now that we have, it has a fullness that we can barely dream of, you know, and we have no idea which moment is coming next, where it's going. And, you know, if we can wake in the morning and realize that as we're waking up this morning, it's no longer yesterday morning. It's this morning. And we have never, ever lived it before.
Right.
And it's so simple, but yet it's a tiny step, but it's actually a big step. Because the world then suddenly comes alive in that mystery of unknowing.
You know, there's a Zen statement that says, whatever comes is it. And I like that one, too. You know, we're not waiting around for something else to happen. whatever shows up, that's it. This day is the only day, right? But you know, we're so conditioned to put our good off till later, or put our attention off actually till later, that we're on autopilot, we're distracted, and what a sad thing it is when we're throwing away our lives. You know, I notice myself doing it sometimes. You know, buying into the storm and stress of things. I think, do I really have to go there? That's a sort of an added extra here. I could just relax and be present and enjoy, even if it's frustrating. Just be present to it and take a load off. You know, drop the struggle, as you say.
It's amazing how our sense of being in life shifts when we do that, you know. And you know, every moment is an opportunity to do that. So yeah, just you know, like, well, why not? Let's see what they're talking about here, and sort of lean back and let this moment, whatever it looks like, let it be what it is, and can we become more intimate with it?
Yeah.
And therefore more intimate, you know, with ourselves. Ultimately, you know, I think what we're really speaking of is intimacy.
Yes.
Because as the notion of being a separate, isolated self begins to soften, so intimacy begins to grow. Intimacy with everything, but intimacy with everything that is presenting itself here in this moment that we have, which is the only moment we have. And so an intimacy implies a connection. You know, when there's that intimacy, there's no longer the sense of separation or alienation, you know. So being willing to open our pores, P-O-R-E-S, the pores of our, not only of our skin, but of our mind, you know, to what is before us, really allows us to live in a more intimate world.
I think so often we think of intimacy and we're really mistaking it for smothering, you know, because, you know, when we think of intimacy, we think, well, the closer I can keep something to me, whether that's a cherished thing or a cherished person, you know, and we end up smothering them instead of giving them the space and giving ourselves the space to truly enjoy the intimacy. And there's a bit of a poem here from the great Polish poet Milosz, right? How do you pronounce that? I can never get my head around it.
Milosz.
Yes. Wonderful poet. But he writes this, very counterintuitive again. Love means to learn to look at yourself the way one looks at distant things. For you are only one thing among many, and whoever sees that way heals his heart. You know, we don't think of it in that way sometimes, that I have to free myself to the spaciousness in order to find myself. A bird and a tree say to him, friend. Wow, that's powerful. And I always find his work very very meaningful, because he cuts through to a deeper level than many poets, I think. But that's a lovely idea, isn't it? To look at the way one looks at distant things. Look at yourself without being so enamored with yourself and all your little ego things that go on. See yourself in right relation, right?
Yes, without really keeping a tight grip on ourselves, or keeping a tight grip on anything or anyone. You know, the tighter our grip on someone or something, clearly the more evident it is that we're afraid.
Yes.
We're afraid of losing something or someone. Right? And yet the paradox is that the more we grip, the more we're going to lose them.
Yeah. Yep.
The more we're going to lose it or them. And so, you know, what Czesław Miłosz is speaking to in that poem is this loosening of one's grip on the way we think things are and the way we think people are. And as we loosen our grip in that way, people and things in our life can reveal themselves to us. And that's what's so new. That's the newness that Gabriel Garcia Marquez was speaking to when he was referring to his wife and saying that, you know, he realized he didn't know her at all. He was releasing his grip on the image he had of her.
Yes.
And so that she herself then, in her mystery, could reveal herself to him more in his sight, you know. And it's the same with everything and everyone. And as we release that grip, intimacy can flower and blossom. There's not really any intimacy in a tight grip. There's really, the grip is the attempt at fusion, and fusion is not intimacy, because in fusion, two people are trying to become one. And
yeah.
That, you know, you can only have intimacy between connected parts of a whole. And as Czeslaw Milosz said, you know, realize you are one thing among many. In other words, you know, you are an absolutely unique and invaluable piece of a vast puzzle. And every single piece of that puzzle, you know, has its place, and it is no more or less important than you are.
Yeah.
And as one experiences that, you know, you know, there's an out-breath and the tight grip can go, you know?
You know, when I my first wife died of breast cancer, for a while afterwards, I couldn't remember what she looked like and couldn't even hear her voice anymore. And, you know, I'd lived with her for 27 years and knew her voice and face very well. But first of all, I was scared. I thought, what, you know, maybe I was living in an illusion. I can't even remember who she was. And then I thought, well, this is okay, because what I knew of her was beyond her face and her voice. You know, it was something deeper. And then I comforted myself with that understanding. And it's funny, after that, I could visualize her face and her voice again and hear her speaking. But I had to go through that moment of you know, the unknown, if you like, the similar to the quote from Marquez there, which, you know, resonates with me because of that.
That's a thank you for sharing that, Paul. It's a beautiful example, because what it sounds like, anyway, to me, is that, you know, even without trying, even actually without wanting to, you let go of your whole idea of her.
Yes.
You let go of the image, you let go of the voice. It simply wasn't graspable by you anymore. And, you know, that allowed you to fall into what was, of course, always there, but that deeper, actually undying connection.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I wrote a poem after it about she was like a wind dagger in my brain, and the passing of light through a colorless glass of water. And there was this, you know, similar image. It was very incisively there, like a scalpel, or like light, and yet totally other as well. You know, totally unknowable, totally beyond my humanness, and that's how I had a relationship with her now. You know, she'd gone into another a dimension, if you like, another awareness. And it was very other, but it was very comforting at the same time. Very strange.
Yeah, well, it's very beautiful, actually. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Let's see, I want to cover some more ground here before we finish. One term you use in the book is fate, you know, and we have different baggage that comes with fate. But I like the idea of dharma, you know, the Eastern or Indian idea that fate or your dharma is that which is yours to do this lifetime, you know, that which gives you meaning. And you sum it up in a way in your obituary that you write about yourself, which is very beautiful. And you're getting away from all the facts of your life to, you know, how you found some kind of meaning in your life, not by forcing it, not by achievement, so much as authenticity. And that's our dharma, isn't it? Is to do that which is ours to do at any given moment.
Yes, I really appreciate the the saying by Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, amor fati, which means to love or the love of one's fate.
Mm-hmm.
But he does not mean, you know, fate in the sense of fatalism, which means that everything is mapped out from beginning to end of your life, and that you're just following along a pre-digested and pre-mapped course. He doesn't mean that. By amor fati, loving your fate, he means that, you know, your fate is actually the moment you are living now. Your dharma is the moment you're living now. Rather than seeing your life as a journey, which we inevitably do because we live in time and therefore see things sequentially, but he's pointing to another way, which is actually beyond time, and what is really beyond time is the present moment, because it's neither here nor there. And the present moment, this timeless moment, is what we actually have as our fate now.
So yes.
How can I best engage with and welcome and acknowledge the fate that I'm being presented with now? And, you know, it appears to us as the moment that we're living. And of course, there are many, many different influences that come into this present moment. See, the word fate actually comes from a Greek word which means portion, a portion. So that fate is just one portion of the influences that are acting upon us right now in this moment. You know, there's another portion is our own particular chemistry and makeup. You know, another portion is the particular time and place that we're occupying right now. You know, all these different causes and consequences are all wrapped up in this very moment we're living now. But our challenge and also our opportunity is to engage with our fate as it's presenting itself to us now.
Yes.
Engage with our dharma now. You know, because this is what we've got.
I think one of the best people to describe this actually is Marcus Aurelius, because, you know, in his meditations, he talks eloquently about this, and he talks about this idea of portion too. You know, what is mine to do, however humble, you know, it's mine, and it has unique significance. Therefore, and he was really good about this. I guess the Stoics in general were, embracing what is as opposed to, you know, worrying about what isn't. And he had numerous struggles in his life, and a lot of relatives who weren't very nice to him, you know, but was a great Roman emperor and a great writer, etc. I take great inspiration from him. Real quick, we have 1 minute left. You went to see Papaji. You know, he's influenced so many people, from Gangaji to Andrew Cohen to Catherine Ingram and many others. Did you think he was... seminal in that way? He was a great teacher, wasn't he?
Yes, at the time I visited Punja in 1990, actually, before the crowds came. In fact, there were only four of us in the room.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
with him. So he was not known, and then 3 months later I went back again with my then partner to Lucknow. And that time was when a woman who's now known as Gangaji appeared, right, was also part of that gathering. But yes, he was a seminal teacher, and clearly he's had quite a profound effect on the Western, or certain aspects of the Western culture, you know, because clearly a lot of individuals were greatly inspired by him. And perhaps some in a rather deluded way. In other words, thinking them that, you know, yes, I think I'm enlightened too. So I'm going to start talking about non-dual.
Right.
And I think now there are hundreds of them.
Yeah, they all thought they were, you know, uniquely gifted by him to go back into the West and be the new, the new enlightened being of the age. Yeah, which tells you something. We're out of time, but it tells you something about humanness that we grab hold of. And you talk about this in the book too: spiritual materialism. Yeah,
because that is the ultimate means of being special.
Yeah, there we go. All right, we're out of time. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Roger. Next week, a Native American wise man and teacher, Dee Wineman, joins me to talk about the wholeness of Native American spirituality. So that'll be a nice dovetail with what we talked about today. But I want to thank Roger. Thank you, Roger, for being with us today. A wonderful show and a wonderful book.
Really great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you, John. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. All right. Take care now, and thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Of spiritually conscious living start now. For a time-tested method to live with purpose and release your infinite potential, tune in to the Yoga Hour, Living the Eternal Way, with Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Pacific, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Often before even beginning, have we declared something impossible? In our mind, we often picture ourselves as inadequate or consider a task too great to attain. Much of our success depends on the thoughts we hold in mind. Our experience depends even more on the persistence with which we affirm those thoughts. A wise person said, "It's a funny thing about life. If you refuse to accept anything but the best, you very often get it." In Unity, we believe in the power of words and thoughts held in mind. If you sincerely ask yourself, "How do I really think things ought to be?" you may be surprised at your answer. You are destined to do great works. Expect it and see the positive changes in your world. This message has been brought to you by the Association of Unity Churches International. To find a Unity Church near you, visit www.unity.org.
Somewhere, tucked away in the Unity Library archives in Unity Village, Missouri, you can find a secret treasure. They are the scripts from Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore's early days on broadcast radio, the teachings of Unity's founders, almost 100 years old. Now, for the first time in history, you can hear them through the power of the Internet. Join Bob Brock every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, for Unity Classic Radio, Words from Our Past. Discover the wisdom of Charles Fillmore's talks and of other Unity Radio speakers read on the air again. Call in your comments and questions as Bob and his special guests revisit Unity Radio talks of the past, along with historical background from the early days of the Unity movement. That's Unity Classic Radio. Words from our past. Every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Right here on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.